Hello again, I'm Warren Olney. Happy New Year. As we record our first To The Point podcast of 2019, President Trump and leaders of Congress are still arguing about how to get all of the federal government open again. We'll take an early look at the new political context for domestic and international policy. The big difference from last year in Washington, Democrats now control the lower house of the Congress. Will that mean greater oversight of President Trump? Campaigns for the next presidential election 2 years from now are already shaping up. How will they affect legislative and executive action? And what are the prospects for this country's role in the world with the president firmly committed to backing away from 70 years of American leadership? We have two writers from The Washington Post, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institute on the more liberal side, Jennifer Rubin, who writes the column Right Turn. Listening in and ready when we get to foreign affairs is Ivo Daalder, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, author of The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership. First, let's go domestic. We don't know when the government will be open again or how that will be achieved. Let's just assume it will happen. First, to E.J. Dionne, good to have you with us.
Always good to be with you.
Jess Unruh, famous Democratic politician in California, used to say the only thing worse for Democrats than losing is winning. What about the situation now in Washington with the new speaker likely to be the old speaker, San Francisco Democrat Nancy Pelosi?
I wish Jess Unruh were around to watch all of this. There are other things he said that are not repeatable on a podcast. Pelosi is in a fascinating position here because she is leading a very diverse group of new Democratic members. If you want to look at the Democratic country, the Democratic Party and the country as a whole, you only have to look at the House membership, which gives them both an interesting opportunity and an interesting responsibility, which is that they have to show, even if they can only pass a bunch of bills that make it through one House and a lot of it gets blocked in the Senate, they have to show what a Democratic agenda should look like. And she has been very careful to focus on issues that help the Democrats win the House, particularly health care, particularly on pre-existing conditions and drug costs, on infrastructure, on political reform, which is where she's going to start a big bill to expand, make it easier for people to vote, to reform the campaign money system and a lot of other provisions and voting rights. And I think that Pelosi and the Democrats in the House are very conscious that they have this responsibility. And what's interesting is that most of the time, you know, we, meaning the people, look to political candidates for president to set a party's agenda for the coming election. But in this case, I think the House is going to have an unusually large role in showing the country this is what Democrats might do if they took power. But as you said, you elided over the shutdown, which was a good way to begin the conversation. But that is going to be the first big challenge. Already, it's a kind of monkey wrench in Pelosi's plans because she was hoping to start with a political reform bill. But she and Chuck Schumer, the leader, Democratic leader in the Senate, have this what looks like a clever way to put the Republicans on the spot. They're passing a whole bunch of bills that the Senate Republicans have already approved to get the government open again, and basically saying to them, why can't you vote for your own bills? They'll probably find a way not to, but it puts them in a very difficult position.
Let me introduce Jennifer Rubin. Good as always to have you once again, the Washington Post Right Turn columnist. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
How are the Republicans going to be able to respond to the kind of challenges that E.J. Dionne suggests, particularly with regard to political reform, given what they've been doing in Wisconsin, in South Carolina, and other places where they have tried to actually nullify the victory of Democrats in statewide elections?
They will respond poorly, I project. And that would be a very, very big mistake. right now, there is a gap between, to put it mildly, between Trump's campaign rhetoric on populism, on draining the swamp, and the reality of an administration that is arguably more corrupt than any in history, whether you talk about the emoluments, the conflicts of interest, the nepotism. And I think the American people haven't given up on that. They still dislike what goes on in Washington, and they still would like it to be cleaned up. You can add in campaign finance reform and some other measures. So if the Republicans were smart, they would either put together their own plan or carve out at least some of what the Democrats have in mind and say, we agree, and try to get that through. That would arguably insulate some of them in 2020 when a third of the Senate and the entire House, of course, is up for reelection. I doubt they will do that, however, because they are still in this trap of their own making. They cannot bring themselves to break with Trump, who would be adamantly opposed to legislation that says you really can't keep those emoluments and you have to release your tax forms. And oh, by the way, you can't have conflicts either by the president or the vice president. You can't employ your relatives. Many, many things that would obviously upset him greatly because he wouldn't be able to comply with them. And Republicans, I imagine, will be compelled to kind of rally around the throne. And unfortunately, that is exactly the wrong place to be. The Democrats, as E.J. put it, are going to be displaying what a Democratic government would look like. And one of the things they're going to be saying is it would be less corrupt. It would be less controlled by big money interests. And if Republicans are going to turn around and defend that, that's going to be a problem for them in 2020. I don't know that they have the nerve or the ability to depart from that dependency on Trump. In the House, of course, they matter really less than ever, and they can squawk all they want, but Nancy Pelosi will command majorities. The question is there anything in the Senate that might happen to shift the balance towards perhaps a more sensible and a more pro-governance agenda? And for that, I want to be keeping an eye on Mitt Romney, who wrote a really startling op-ed in the Washington Post on to start off the new year, as well as a small group of Republicans who are up for re-election in purple or blue states in 2020 and may see it in their interest to align at least on these sorts of issues with some of the Democrats.
I want to get back to Mitt Romney and that fascinating piece that he wrote in the Washington Post, but first let me go back to E.J. Dionne. You indicated at the outset that we have a very diverse group of new Democrats. A lot of them think that the Democratic establishment is just as tied to Wall Street, just as tied to big business as the Republicans are, and they want to see some real substantive difference.
Right. Well, that's where this big political reform package comes in for Pelosi and this new majority, which, by the way, is supported across the board from left to center in the Democratic caucus, because it's a message that says we are reducing the dependence of political parties on Wall Street money by creating a system, a partially publicly financed system, where small candidates are being encouraged to accept only small contributions, and for that they would be rewarded with matching funds that would match the smaller contributions. So there is definitely that sentiment, and then there is a difference in view between, say, a new member like Abigail Spanberger from the suburbs of Richmond, who's a more moderate Democrat elected in a very conservative district, and then more progressive Democrats like Ayanna Pressley in Boston, Ocasio-Cortez from New York, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. And I think that these new Democrats, what they share is they're a new generation, and they share some of those frustrations you described, but philosophically they have differences. And I think, again, in showing how Democrats can govern, I think it's going to be very important that these different I don't want to call them factions because they're not factions yet, but these people with different ideological orientations can get along and actually govern together. And I think that one of the reasons Pelosi got reelected as Speaker, despite some opposition to her, is because most Democrats think she is probably better placed than anyone to get different factions of Democrats working together. But I think the thing to look out for going forward is less an ideological split than a generational split in the Democratic Party. I think younger Democrats and younger potential supporters of the Democrats, probably more importantly, are just very impatient with politics generally. And this, you know, older Democratic leadership is going to have to be very alive to this generational split in the party.
So, Jennifer Rubin, I presume you don't think that Republicans in the Senate, even those in blue and purple states, are going to go along with the kind of political reforms that the Democrats are proposing. Am I correct in that?
I think the vast majority of them will not. What will be interesting is to see if any of them split on any of these issues and can form a sort of rump faction that might unite. On the other hand, getting to 60 votes in the Senate, which is what they'll need to pass this sort of thing, will be practically impossible for them. So it's more, I think, an indication of where the party is going in the future, whether they continue to tie themselves to the mast and the sinking mast of President Trump, or whether they see the necessity for thinking beyond Trump and separating themselves from Trump going forward to 2020.
So let's see if somebody out of the past is going to have an impact on the future. Mitt Romney, as you mentioned, Republican from Utah, now a U.S. senator, soon to be sworn in, the 2012 nominee for president of the Republican Party, has written an article in the Washington Post about President Trump, in which he begins, or doesn't begin, but in one paragraph he begins by saying, "A presidency shapes the political character of the nation." He says a president should demonstrate the essential qualities of honesty and integrity. But he goes on to say that this is where the incumbent's shortfall has been the most glaring. With a nation so divided, resentful, and angry, presidential leadership and qualities of character is indispensable. How important is that? Is he setting himself up to be Mr. Trump's challenger? Should Mr. Trump still be around in the primaries in 2020?
Has that potential. I think the big question for Mitt Romney is whether he's going to follow the model of Jeff Flake, which was to write beautiful op-eds, write a book, give moving speeches on the Senate floor, but really not do a heck of a lot to take on the Trumpized Republican Party, or whether he is really going to carve his own way. And he lists in that piece not only the ethical issues, which clearly he puts front and center, but things like foreign policy. So will he support a move, for example, to cut off arms sales to Saudi Arabia in the wake of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a contributor to the Washington Post? Will he, for example, really press the new Secretary of Defense when he's nominated, maybe the acting Secretary of Defense or maybe somebody new, on his qualifications and his intentions vis-a-vis our Asian allies, for example, who are now learning that our North Korea policy is a lot more smoke and mirrors than real substance. So the proof really is in the pudding for him, and he's going to have to figure out if there are ways in which he can challenge the president on substance so that if he does decide to challenge him in 2020, there'll be a difference. Running against a guy who's sort of against Trump doesn't really make a lot of sense. What makes sense is to say, I represent either the pre-Trump GOP or a future of the GOP without Trump, and here's what that would look like. One of the things, for example, he sets forth is to repair our fiscal foundation. Well, is he going to vote to extend the Trump tax cuts, which opened up a gashing hole in the deficit and the debt? Is he going to, for example, vote to reopen the government rather than spend $5 billion on an unnecessary, wasteful wall? These statements that he makes have real-world implications, and I'm going to be looking in the first few days, in the first weeks and months ahead, to see how he translates that into some kind of action and whether he is able to galvanize a group of Republicans within the Senate that wouldn't perhaps reach 60 votes but could reach more than 50, for example, in dinging a nominee who was blatantly unqualified, or in pressing a nominee for certain commitments, as I think are appropriate with respect to, for example, the Attorney General nominee on the Russia investigation. There's a lot of question marks regarding his determination and what he actually plans to do. If he carries through on the things he wrote about, I think he will set himself up, yes, as a clear primary challenger, or at least a threat to Trump, and more importantly, as sort of a clarion call to the rest of the Republicans that they too can take on Trump, that he needn't be either the one to challenge Trump in the primaries or the only one, that others can do this too. So I think of all the people in the Senate, he has perhaps the most important role to determine in the near term where which way the party goes.
Jennifer Rubin, now with the right turn column for The Washington Post, clearly not a conservative who is supportive of President Trump. We will be back with her and our other guests in just a moment on this first To the Point podcast of 2019.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with our first podcast of 2019, and I want to go back to Jennifer Rubin with the right term, Washington Post column. You indicated you thought that the Trump administration is the most corrupt in history. That's exactly what George McGovern said about Richard Nixon's administration in 1972. Why do you think it is that Trump still has this base support in the Republican Party, especially amongst Christian conservatives?
That is the $64,000 question, isn't it? Why this group of evangelical leaders decided to enter into a Faustian bargain with Trump? They took someone who they, in a million years, would never have supported as a, if he were a Democrat, in terms of his personal life, in terms of his public conduct, in terms of his public rhetoric, and in terms of many of the positions, frankly, that he's taken in the past. And they decided to essentially, you know, sell their souls to this guy, put in on the premise that he would reward them with judges that they liked and other social policies, which perhaps he really hasn't come forward on. There's not too much else other than the judges he's been able to deliver for them, and that they would kind of get what they wanted. It was a very cynical, cold-eyed assessment that they are not going to be the what we used to call the values voters or the moral majority. They've given up on all that. They just want to have political power and access. And because of that, they made this deal with him, and he has delivered at least on judges. And for them, that's enough. They have also attained unparalleled power and influence in the party. When in the past, they were simply one of several groups, if you will, business Republicans, hawkish Republicans, fiscal conservatives. They really have come out sort of on top in the party, and they show no sign of relinquishing their hold on him. This, of course, is solidified, cemented by the media bubble that they and many other more secular Republicans exist in, where we have a kind of parallel universe where the wall is very vital and necessary, where there is a surge of illegal immigrants coming over the border, all of these things that simply aren't true, but that are repeated again and again in Fox News and in the right-wing media chamber, echo chamber. So they become very resistant, impervious, in fact, to facts and to new developments. They will go down with the ship. But let's also remember that when Richard Nixon, who you just spoke of, left office, he still had about 27% Republican support, 27% support in the country, which was almost exclusively Republican. So it's not as if they have to suddenly convert in order for Trump to fall apart politically. It's that they have to be, their base of support has to really be segregated from just about everyone else who is willing to take in information and see Trump with a somewhat objective eye, because he really can't survive with 30% or less of the electorate. That doesn't work in a presidential election. It didn't work in the House race. That was a really swift and thorough rebuke of the notion that he could play only to the base and that the base would sustain him politically. He will continue to do that, however, and I think these people will continue to cling to him. The real question, however, is whether a combination of the economy maybe softening a bit, the markets yo-yoing up and down, international instability, this specter of corruption, the impending Mueller report, if all those things shake the nerve of everyone else in the Republican Party, and whether you for the first time really see a divide between those sorts of Republicans and Trump and his very, very firm, very, very fervent evangelical base.
E.J. Dionne, back to the issue of the Republican evangelicals. You've written a bit about this and cited some interesting authorities on how deep this goes.
Right. Well, I think with the evangelicals, what you're seeing is something old and something new. We forget that a lot of these voters are Southern white conservatives who shifted Republican long before there was any organized religious right. It was a kind of backlash. It was not a kind of. It was a backlash against civil rights and against Lyndon Johnson's embrace of the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts in 1964 and 1965. And so with Trump making rather explicit racial appeals, we'll be charitable, this group is kind of voting as it always has voted for candidates who were conservative, again, being charitable on race. So that's the old part. The new part is I think you're seeing a lot of Christian conservatives become what you might call Christian nationalists. And there's a lot of rhetoric coming out of the right-wing Christians now that is far more nationalist than it is Christian. And you're hearing that from Jerry Falwell Jr., and a lot of other people. So I think that's also at work here. It's not, it is in some ways the same old movement that it was, but in other ways, its views are hardening. And these are also older Americans who are very upset with the cultural turn in the country. And the comparison is made, the biblical comparison, somebody wrote an op-ed about this the last couple of days, with King Cyrus, who was not himself a Jew, but protected the Jewish people. Evangelicals see Trump as someone who may be deeply flawed, but they see as a strong shield for their values. And if I could just go back real briefly to the Mitt Romney op-ed, I think that a lot of people are welcoming Romney speaking out against Trump. But Romney's problem is, if I can paraphrase a senator from the state he was once governor of, he was for Trump before he was against Trump, before he was for Trump, before he was against Trump. He's had several iterations in his attitudes toward Trump. He welcomed his support in 2012. He turned on him in 2016. He re-embraced him when he wanted a Senate seat, and now he's back at him. Now, that doesn't reduce the significance of his piece, because I think he may be speaking for an unease that is growing in the Republican Party. So I don't dismiss the piece, but as Jennifer suggested, we got to see some action to back up these words.
When we get to the issue of nationalism, you have just mentioned it, that's a way of segueing into the subject of foreign affairs. And I want to introduce, as promised, Ivo Dalder, who is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO, who's author of The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership, and who also has an article in Foreign Affairs called The Committee to Save the World Order. Ivo Dalder, Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
What's the Committee to Save the World Order? What are you talking about?
Well, for the last 70 years, the United States has played a quite unique role in international affairs. It's been a leader, the leader of the free world, that maintained a system of international order, what we call the liberal or rules-based international order, based on the ideas of strong alliances and cooperative security, of open markets and free trade, and the promotion of democracy, human rights, and freedom. And the U.S., since 1945, in the aftermath of World War II, and having learned the lessons of both the First and the Second World War, decided that peace, prosperity, and freedom depended on the United States wanting to be a leader and being a leader in both creating and maintaining this order. We have seen an erosion of this over time and an accelerated erosion under President Trump, who has moved away from the idea of the United States as a leader of the free world to the United States as a country that stresses nationalism that EJ just talked about and puts America first and America, frankly, alone. The Committee of the to Save the Free World Order is a construct that Jim Lindsay and I, who both wrote the piece and The Empty Throne, came up with the idea that there are nine strong allies in Europe and Asia and North America who should take up the mantle of global leadership while the United States under Trump has given it away in order to maintain the world order, in order to maintain strong security alliances, deep engagement in diplomacy, strong commitments to international trade, and a commitment to freedom and democracy, and to hope that at some point in the future, the United States will once again become the leader it has been in the last 70 years, but until such time, to have these nine countries cooperate together. This is Japan, Australia, South Korea, the United Kingdom, Italy, France, Germany, Canada, and the European Union. Those are the nine, to cooperate in maintaining an international order from which they have greatly benefited, and frankly, we in the United States have greatly benefited.
You pointed out in your article that they have, together, enormous economic impact on the world.
They do. They together dominate the trading system with the United States and with China. They have their 80% of all foreign and development aid comes from these countries. Much of the trade that is conducted across the Atlantic and indeed across Europe, the Pacific, is conducted by these countries with either the United States or among themselves. Even militarily, 7 of the 10 largest spenders on defense are those countries, and of course the largest one is the United States. That's why they are strong and important allies to the U.S. and have been for 70 years, have been fundamentally part of a global order that has been extraordinarily good to Americans, to Europeans, to Asians, to much of the world. And they now need to use that power that they do have economically, politically, and militarily to sustain an order that has depended for a very long time on American leadership but is no longer can rely on American leadership.
Let me turn quickly to Jennifer Rubin. I know you need to leave us, and I'm sorry for that, but I do want to ask you, Mr. Dalder just said there's been an erosion of support for American leadership in the world, and I presume he means in the United States. If there has been an erosion of support here, and if Mr. Trump is playing on it, why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think there are many causes. One has been certainly these very long wars without a finite, definitive victory. That certainly plays into it. I also think that involvement in the world is hard and takes real leadership. And when you have presidents who are committed to it, willing to spend the political capital, willing to spend American resources, then you can help that support stay at a level that can sustain an active America. When, however, you play to Americans' worst fears, to their isolationist tendency, to their xenophobia, it's not surprising that support goes down, particularly in the Republican Party, where you've seen this dramatic about-face, a party that takes great pride in having helped bring the Soviet Union to their knees, now is a sort of pro-Putin echo chamber for President Trump, a party that really carved away on human rights, whether it was in the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, has now thrown their lot in with the likes of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and Kim Jong-un, who the president has nothing but praise to say for. So I think all of these factors together, but I will say this, I have in mind a different kind of committee to save the liberal international order, and that's one in which the ambassador, people like Anthony Blinken, people like Jake Sullivan, the big minds and the very strong voices in the Democratic Party who have supported an international liberal order, who have resisted the pull on their own side towards isolationism and retrenchment really step to the fore. And as we enter a presidential race that's going to go on for about 2 years, that they offer themselves to really all the campaigns that would have them in order to advocate a responsible foreign policy. My great fear as someone who very much regrets the turn in foreign policy is that the Republicans might nominate someone who is as bad on foreign policy as Trump is, who is as committed to sort of America first, although they won't put it in those terms, as Trump is. We would be in a very, very bad position if that came about. So if Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, and I'm hopeful that he will not, then the Democrats have to be the grown-ups in foreign policy. And I think the ambassador is fully qualified to help them do that, along with some of the other names that I've mentioned. So put down no one vote for the ambassador and others to lead the way on the foreign policy agenda for Democratic candidates for 2020.
Jennifer Rubin, again, a conservative blogger for The Washington Post. She writes the Right Turn column. Great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
E.J. Dionne, very quickly, how solidly did President Obama support the world order that seems now to be dissolving to some extent?
Well, he made Ivo Dalder his ambassador to NATO, so that was a strong support for the world order. Just a quick note. I think that there is a problem facing people who support a strong American engagement in the world because of the failures of what, for lack of a better term, I will call the foreign policy establishment in the Bush years forward. There is enormous impatience in the country with the war in Iraq, with a war in Afghanistan that was not resolved. And so it shouldn't surprise us in the least that there is a backlash against the old way of doing foreign policy and a real exhaustion on the part of the American people with a whole series of foreign commitments. And Trump plays on that. The other side of it is that I've been thinking that the philosopher who is most relevant to our moment is the folk singer Joni Mitchell, who said, "You don't know what you got till it's gone." And I think Trump is reminding a lot of people, including people on the left, that for all of their impatience with policies that have been pursued over the last 15 or 20 years, a world with a strong American influence in it is a better world than a world without it, a world in which the liberal democracies of the world are together and acting together is a better world than a world in which they splinter. I think Obama broadly upheld an internationalist view of foreign policy, and he was very impatient with these foreign commitments, which is why he withdrew our troops from Iraq. I think there were some mistakes in the Obama years. I think that laying down the red line in Syria and then not acting proved to be a more serious error than I think Obama felt at the time. Nonetheless, Obama was a strong upholder of this international order, and he was trying to correct some of the overreach that occurred during the Bush years. And we're going to have to take both those lessons into account going forward.
Ambassador Dalder, let me go back to you. Is it true that the foreign policy establishment, presumably yourself included, have to some extent failed to understand the impatience, the anger, the misunderstanding, I suppose, partly, or failure to understand because it hasn't been well enough explained, of so many Americans about the commitments that we have overseas without, as Jennifer Rubin suggested, any definitive victories and no indication of why we're supporting all of these countries with so much money and so many troops without that?
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair criticism. I think there is a sense in the foreign policy establishment, if there is such a thing, that the way we have conducted ourselves over the past 70 years is the normal way. We don't really have to explain it anymore. We really don't have to make the point why it is important for the United States to lead, why it is important for it to be part of strong, capable alliances to deal with real and potential threats in the future, why free trade is important. why the commitment to human rights and democracy is important, we've sort of taken that for granted. And in some ways, we've overstretched ourselves. We've gone too far, both on the economic side, believing that economic liberalization by having Russia or China be a member of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, that would automatically lead to political liberalization. That hasn't happened. I also think that we've overestimated the power that the United States had in the post-Cold War period to change the internal structures of other societies. We've been at war in Afghanistan in 18 years, and the situation from a security and a political and even economic perspective today is no better and in some cases worse than it has was at the outset of our engagement. So no doubt that the establishment needs to make a better case for American leadership, but frankly ought to take a deeper look at some of the questions that have arisen, not just because of the Trump presidency and campaign, but frankly because of the failures of our foreign policy for the past 20 and 25 years, and to see whether there isn't a reassessment necessary. However, and there is a however, it is important to really make the case that our engagement in the world and our leadership as part of that engagement is absolutely critical to our security, to our prosperity, and indeed to our freedom. That the lessons we learned in 1940-45, the worst world war we went through, are lessons that are still true, that a United States that does not lead, a United States that is not engaged in the world, is not only a United States that will be poorer and less secure, but will also be leaving a world that is poorer and less secure, and which war and conflict and economic depression is that much more likely. So I think there is a consensus, a view in the middle of the political system here in the United States. I don't think it's just Democrats. I think there are many Republicans, including Mitt Romney in his op-ed piece in the Washington Post that you were talking about earlier. Many people who did not join the Trump administration and people who did join the Trump administration, who believe in the importance of American leadership, who believe in the importance of strong alliances, who believe in the importance of allies. Read Jim Mattis's resignation letter as probably the strongest cry from the heart, cri de coeur, in terms of the importance of partnership and alliances to American security. And we need to make that case again, particularly since the president has insisted that allies play us for suckers, as he put it in Iraq the other day, and that we and our military are somehow need to be paid for what it is that we do. We don't need to be paid for what we do. We do what we do because it's important to our security. It's important to our future and to our freedom. That's why we have a military that is engaged in the world. That's why we have allies. That's why we have trade agreements. That's why we have foreign deployments. That's why we have diplomacy. And it's making those cases over and over again that is now more important than ever.
I can't quote Joni Mitchell exactly, as was done earlier by E.J. Dionne, but referring to the idea that you don't realize what you've got until it's gone. What about the fact that President Trump now wants to abrogate the treaty made by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev with regard to the limitation of nuclear weapons? How important, Mr. Ambassador, is that?
Well, I think it's very unfortunate to make this this move, which the president announced a few weeks ago, which is to get out of a treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, that bans an entire class of weapons, ground-based missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,000 kilometers, that the United States and Russia produced. That class was eliminated under the agreement signed, as you mentioned, by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. It was really the signature of that agreement that was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Much happened afterwards, including the end of the Berlin Wall. But it was that agreement that said we can actually improve the situation that both our countries face through dialogue and getting rid of nuclear weapons rather than building more. And it's true that the treaty for some time has been violated by Russia. That is a major problem. It is something that one needs to address. One needs to address first and foremost through active diplomacy rather than shouting from the hilltops. And then make it an assessment. Are we better off with a treaty, even if there is a possibility that one side is not fully abiding by it while we're trying to find a way to come to a solution on that, but with that treaty, or are we better off without it? The reality is we don't need ground-based nuclear weapons in Europe or indeed in Asia. We have air-based systems. We have sea-based systems that can do the job for us. And the other reality is we won't find any country that is willing to deploy these weapons. There is no European country saying that now that the INF Treaty is gone, we should start deploying long-range nuclear weapons on our soil, not in Germany, not in Poland, not anywhere in Europe, nor in Asia. So it's regrettable that it is once again a Republican president that is undermining an agreement negotiated by a Republican president before him, in this case Reagan and Trump. The ABM Treaty, which was a major treaty negotiated under Richard Nixon, was abandoned by George W. Bush. The common denominator, I should note, in both is that John Bolton, now National Security Advisor under George W. Bush, a major player in the arms control field, was at the center of both of those decisions. Mr. Bolton is not known for liking arms control, and he has now succeeded in, looks like, convincing President Trump to walk away from an agreement that that really started at the end of the Cold War.
Subject of special importance to me, and I think we'll talk about it again and again as this year goes on our podcast. E.J. Dionne, back to you. Once again, we have the beginning of presidential candidacies, and I'm wondering, do you think that the Democrats will make foreign policy much of an issue? Generally speaking, it really hasn't been much of an issue.
I don't think foreign policy will be a major issue in the Democratic primaries. I think you will see some divisions and some argument about you know, what the nature of American commitments in the world should be. There are, for example, Democrats who opposed Obama's original commitment of those troops to Syria that Trump is pulling out. On the other hand, I'm also struck by the fact that even some of those Democrats are now saying that the ragtag way in which Trump, at least until a couple of days ago, seemed to be pulling those troops out and abandoning our Kurdish allies, even those who oppose that commitment are saying this is the wrong path. I think Trump has reminded a lot of Democrats who are skeptical of intervention that they nonetheless support a strong international order, believe in allies, and believe in alliances, and that the I think that the distinction I would make is one that John Judis in his new book, The Nationalist Revival, makes, sort of hiving off the idea of internationalism, which many of us support because we are stronger acting in concert than acting alone, from globalism and globalization, where there are a lot of questions being raised about how the combination of globalization and rapid technological change is affecting the living standards of an awful lot of people. And I think we have to have a serious conversation of how we lift up both the people and the places that have been left out in this new international economic order, if you will. We have to have that conversation alongside a conversation that defends the idea of America's engagement in the world. I think if they get too closely together, if they are brought too closely together and you deny the problems created by globalization, you're opening the way for the sort of sweeping argument Trump makes that we just want to pull out of the world altogether, and that is obviously not a good idea.
I just want to mention one more issue, and it's the one emphasized by Jerry Brown, the outgoing governor of California after four terms in office of the biggest state in the union, and that is climate change. Here's what he said about it on Meet the Press this weekend.
I would point to the fact that it took Roosevelt many, many years to get America willing to go into World War II and fight the Nazis. Well, we have an enemy, okay, though different, but perhaps very much devastating in a similar way, and we got to fight climate change, and the president's got to lead on that.
What about climate change and its importance as a foreign policy issue?
So not only is it absolutely vital to the future of mankind and womankind, humankind, it is absolutely vital that we start working together with other countries on dealing with this. And if there is one area where America first, and the idea that we can put our interests ahead of those of the rest of the world, where that makes no sense, it's the issue of climate change. Climate change is not something that respects borders. It's not something that respects nations. It is something that is happening to all of us at the same time. All of us in different ways, depending on where we live on the globe, but it is affecting all of us. And the only way we're going to be able to deal with that fundamental challenge, a challenge that is going to be with us for generations, is if we work together. And one of the great achievements at the end of the Obama administration was the United States working together with China, a country that we have many differences with, economic, military, political. But on this issue, we were able to come together and forge a international consensus that 195 countries joined in Paris to finally put numeric targets for each of our nations on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And this is something you do through international cooperation. It's not something you can solve through a national action only. It's something that requires nations to work together, and it is something that requires nations like the United States to take a leadership role in. And in order to bring countries together, in order to help countries understand the importance of their own interests and why it makes sense to get together in resolving these issues. And this is the world we're living in. We're finding that there are more and more issues that transcend borders, whether it is climate change, whether it is the proliferation of nuclear weapons, whether it is terrorism, the growth of pandemic and other diseases, and indeed migration of peoples, the largest number of people now being migrating around the world since World War II, that cannot be solved unless there is international cooperation. And there is no international cooperation unless and until the United States takes a leadership role. That's why it is so important that we reverse the trend that we have embarked upon in the last few years, which is a belief that the United States can abdicate its global leadership and take once again the step that is necessary for us to work with others to lead in addressing these challenges, climate change being the most important and the most immediate one that we face.
And we will see to what extent climate change becomes an issue in the next presidential campaign and in the legislative activity and just the political conversation that goes on Capitol Hill and around the country as more and more candidates begin to compete to be the President of the United States. Ivo Dalder, again, former U.S. Ambassador to NATO, author now of The Empty Throne, America's Abdication of Global Leadership. I should have said co-author with James Lindsay. He also was very much a part of it. E.J. Dionne with the Brookings Institution, also The Washington Post, his latest book, One Nation After Trump. He also co-authored that with Norm Ornstein and Tom Mann, who we've had on our program many times. And thanks to Jennifer Rubin with The Washington Post's Right Turn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? It paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Our To The Point podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer was Chuck Prebatary. And we got audio assistance from Chris Wotherspoon. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe and let us know what you'd like to hear from us and what you think of what you've been hearing on To The Point.